Don't slip on the ice like I did. Be careful out there. I am very excited to meet someone for the first time, listened to him, watched him play, and since I am a lifelong Sox fan, we have DJ Darren Jackson in the studio. And Ed, you're sticking around too?
I never left.
Ed's been here since yesterday, Wendy. He will not leave.
Everybody talk to donuts, I'm staying, Wendy. Come on, you know that.
Darren, you played for the Cubs and you played for the White Sox at different times. You're good, but you can't play for both teams at the same time. That's impossible. What's the difference between being a White Sox player and a Cub player?
I look at it this way. I started on one side of town and finished on the right side of town. So, the truth is, I loved being drafted by the Cubs. That was an amazing place to start my career. It actually set me up, to be honest with you, because of the following the Cubs had.
Yeah.
I didn't know any different. I thought every team had that kind of following. I got traded to San Diego. When I got there, I go, where are all the fans?
Right.
How come when we get off the bus, there's not fans waiting for us in this city and that city? Only to find out when I went to the team after that, it was the same way with them. I go, okay, obviously it's a Cubs thing. Okay. So, they got the national following. It was great. But coming over to the White Sox, it's funny because I realized it was serious baseball.
Yeah.
And the fans were, hey, we're in it, but we're in it. You guys got to give us the right effort. It was two different sides of this town, that's for sure. More of an entertainment factor compared to, hey, we're business here.
Right.
And I'm happy where I am, especially since I chose to be back to the White Sox at the end of my career.
Yes.
And that's where I wanted to finish, and it's worked out pretty well.
What breaks my heart, I mean, you are usually what your parents or grandparents are. My grandfather used to sit there with his little black and white TV with the coat hanger for an antenna, and UHF, he would watch the White Sox games. What is it that Sox fans, like myself, why don't we fill up the park? What's going on? What can I do to help? Please. Ed.
Oh, you want me to take this one?
The more cerebral questions.
Darren's out quicker than I thought.
I answer for that one with no problem.
Ed, go back to your history as a kid watching the White Sox. Here we go.
Yep.
No, it just breaks my heart because you go to a game. I love it because my kids are older. They're teenagers now. But bring in a family there. What a great atmosphere. How can we get the word out that that's the place to be? All right.
I think we're doing that right now. You're doing a good job. Keep going. Okay, just keep going, Wendy, please.
All right. I guess to defray this, maybe DJ could sing a little something. You sing in the booth with that all the time, and highly entertained.
Well,
Blue Bayou was my favorite.
Choruses.
I only do that when Ed's prodding me with the cattle prodder there. I mean, other than that, I wouldn't dare. It is radio. There's supposed to be music and singing.
We crossed that bridge.
This is a dream job, isn't it, for both of you, to go in every day, to not only be able to watch baseball, but convey the message to the fans. That's a dream job, right?
We're going to take you away from your everyday life in some aspect.
We're
going to give you White Sox baseball. If we're not playing good, he and I will go to a different tangent to get the point across.
Yep.
But we certainly want you at the ballpark, and we want tuned to WGN Radio. If you're not on the radio, then watch us on TV, on WGN TV.
Yep.
That's what we want to do.
Beautiful. Well said.
You know, last night we had White Sox events going on across the town here, and I came across a fan, and he said he loves listening to Ed and I, which was a great compliment. He said, but, you know, the thing that's most interesting is when there's a game that's kind of out of hand now, but you and Ed take it to another level with the entertainment, and that's when it's really fun. And that's good to hear, because I looked at him, I said, well, that's the whole point for us is – baseball is baseball. That's great. And when there's a good game, we're giving you the game. But at the same time, when it gets out of hand, you're losing 11-1 in the third inning. How are we going to keep the listeners going? Well, it becomes the Ed and Darren show. We have fun. We talk about some other things. And why else would you want to listen if it's just there's a ground ball to short? So
is
we take it a different direction.
Is the mindset different if the White Sox are up 11-1 or if they're down 11-1? Does that play into the game set a little bit for you guys of what to present?
You're going to know it when we're losing.
Yeah.
Both of us are not happy to lose.
Yeah, you can tell.
Well, not good losers.
Wendy, you just said it. I have had a lot of people say they can turn the radio on and hear Ed's voice and know if we're winning or losing.
Exactly.
Simple as that. I mean, so he's giving you the influx of, oh, man.
I hate losing.
Or we're going, hey, you know, so... You get it right away. He doesn't even have to give the score. It's like, hey, they're losing. I'm changing the channel. I don't know what people are doing, but that they know immediately.
It comes from my days of listening, to Bob Elson doing the games when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And he goes through the lineage. Now, there was a ball that was hit. I don't care about that. Is the guy out? That's all I want to know.
Yeah.
And hopefully this year we'll get a lot more outs than we did last year in key situations.
We asked Ed this question yesterday, Darren, but who was the influence on you as a broadcaster, not as a player? Ed said Vin Scully, the great Vin Scully. Did you have somebody like that that served as kind of an inspiration for you?
Well, I didn't realize I was going to be in this position to be a broadcaster first and foremost, but yeah. I grew up with Vin Scully and Chick Kern out in Los Angeles doing basketball for the Lakers and Vin doing Dodgers baseball. So it was a great environment to listen to games being called. But, you know, I was fortunate because when I did come up through the system with the Cubs, I also had Jimmy Pearsall around me. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy Pearsall was my outfield instructor, and he was also a broadcaster. Mm-hmm. It was all these things in Chicago. And he was a big influence on me because I followed the same path. And when I first saw him, when I changed over from the field to the broadcast booth, the first thing he said to me when I saw him down in Arizona was, be yourself. Mm. Don't let anybody tell you what to do. Be yourself up there. Don't change a thing. And Jimmy knew me well enough. I used to go to dinner with him and his wife and with some other players. And that was great advice. So Jimmy Pearsall probably in that sense.
That combination of he and Harry Carey in the 70s doing baseball games was just insane.
Yeah, I heard about that.
I'm going to tell you this. He made Harold Baines a good outfielder. And Darren won't say this, but he had Darren under his thumb as well.
Really?
He'll tell you about it. But Harold Baines, another thing about Vin Scully, he could stretch out Dodger baseball with a bat. Dodge! You know,
right.
He had that bottom.
Right.
And, John Rooney was also a cadence count with Rooney. He wanted me, this is the way you're going to do this.
Yeah.
And worked with John for a long time before he went down to St. Louis. So he's always there for me to grasp something he said to me in key situations. Don't call it too fast.
Mm-hmm.
Call it on time and let the crowd tell you what's going on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long have you been doing this?
I started doing this.
We were talking off the air. I grew up in Brookfield. I went to Riverside Brookfield High School, and there in Brookfield was the Roy A. Overholt Field and Babe Ruth. You pitched over there?
Yeah.
Where haven't you pitched?
Well, you know, as a kid growing up, Joe Porvecchio was my coach at St. Rita. Well, he had me in a farm system when I was 13 years of age, and I didn't know it. I was playing Connie Mack at 13. I didn't win any games, and then they put me at the Colt League at 14, and it was a joke. And at 15, I've never said this before, I wasn't good enough to play with the kids in the neighborhood. So I used to play by myself against the wall at the National Food Store at 79th in California. And I would nobody would play with me because I didn't know how to catch.
Yeah.
So my mom got me a rubber-coated league baseball.
Mm-hmm.
I threw it against the wall, and I found out that if I moved it one way, it bounced off the wall the opposite way. And I would run back and forth and catch ground balls. So I learned how to play. I wanted to be the best player in my neighborhood, and I was certainly one of those. Then I wanted to be the best player on the south side of Chicago, and I became one of those. And then I was one of the best players in the state of Illinois. And then I wanted to make the All-Star team for my friends who rehabbed me from rotator cuff. That's why I didn't have a goal to make the All-Star team. But they wanted to go to the game. It was sold out in Los Angeles, so I put down, I'd save 14 games in a half season with the Sox. So I said, I'll save 17 and a half season, and I got to be 5-1. So I wrote it down on a piece of paper. I looked at it each month from October of 79 into 1980. They called me a week before the All-Star team. Welcomed me. Lee McPhail called me. I had that piece of paper with me. I had 17 saves. I was 5-1. I got the win on Sunday before I went to Los Angeles. I was 6-1. I was leading the league in saves.
Not too bad, Ed.
I'd say you're
not too bad.
But if everybody has goals and you're stringent with that and you want to do it, you can go do it.
Yeah.
Darren, how old were you when you first had a catch? And that's not even correct vernacular.
No, it's Field of Dreams speak.
I know. Right? It's Field of Dreams.
Yeah. It's giving birth. We're just going to have a
shut up, Ed. You have a donut, will you? Let Darren talk.
What'd you do? Tell him to take
it? No, it's like the broadcast. I'm not going to get anything in here. I'm done.
I know.
Sorry.
How old were you when you first started really playing baseball and knew you loved it?
Well, didn't know I loved it till I was probably about 11 years old, but started playing in Little League at age 7, like most kids. My mom forced me. I had to go do something. And
unlike my kids, you stuck with it.
Well, I didn't want to, trust me.
Really?
At age 7, I'm like, I don't want to play this. This stinks. And then the next year, when I was 8, I said, I don't want to play. My mom said, oh, no, you're going back out there to play again. I'm like, oh, great. So the second year I played, it wasn't as bad. The coach was a little nicer, one of those kind of things.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I guess I'll go back for a third year. And from there, I started getting it. And so basically, and I talked to a lot of kids about that. When it first starts, you know, this is how it started for me. It's not the easiest. You'll figure it out about this age, probably. And a lot of kids, I've worked with some during the off season, and they're getting into that stage now. So, you know, just because it stinks when you first start doesn't mean a few years from now.
Sure.
Your parents know what they're talking about, folks. Listen, kids.
Solid
parents,
advice.
Just listen to them.
Solid advice. All right, hold those thoughts. Ed and DJ are here. We're talking about Sox Fest. It's Bill and Wendy. More of this in just a minute on WGN. It's Bill F. It's Wendy Snyder. Sox Fest is this weekend. We're celebrating with Ed Farmer and Darren Jackson. Guys, Barry Bonds, yes or no, should he be in the Hall of Fame?
No.
No?
No.
Ed?
No.
Nope.
He was my teammate last year I played.
Yeah.
Great.
That's why I shouldn't be in there.
Just for that.
I also want to say this about my partner.
Yes.
When you saw him play, there's a reason why he was drafted by the Cubs in a certain round.
Mm-hmm.
He could throw. He could get the ball in the outfield. And whatever Pearsall taught him, he took to task. They would hit the ball. He'd just turn and start running and go back and catch it and throw it in.
Mm-hmm.
So with him, you're getting a different dynamic of a regular player.
Mm-hmm.
Most guys aren't as skilled as he was when he signed and took that to the big leagues. When you look at the lineage of people that have played in the big leagues, that career doesn't make 5 years usually.
Yeah, right.
To get 10, you get a gold pass. Have you guys ever seen that?
Mm-mm.
I'll bring it to the ballpark. He's got one also.
Oh.
And you get free access to a ball game. Problem is, for him and I mean, it's not a problem. I don't want to say that. We never use the passes. Because we're working,
working
the games, yeah. But if you get hit with this pass, it's going to leave a mark on you. It's not as big a deal.
Isn't it strange though that the player with the most home runs of all time is not in the Hall of Fame? The player with the most hits of all time, Pete Rose, is not in the Hall of Fame. Roger Clemens is kind of on the fence at this point.
He's
Mark McGuire, you don't think he'll get it either?
I don't think he deserves to get it.
No,
the rest of us were playing on, you know, a cup of coffee maybe,
yeah,
and an aspirin to make sure we weren't sore.
Yeah,
that's about it.
What about the people who say there should be a separate wing of the Hall of Fame for players with tainted pasts?
The outcasts?
The outcast part of the Hall of Fame.
Where do you want to put that one?
Way in the back.
Where do you want to build that wing? New York, we're not going there.
Paramus.
I think the problem we have now, and it's hard for the people that have the votes for the Hall of Fame, is do you truly know who and who was not on steroids or anything else?
Yeah,
we know certain guys. I mean, as former players, we knew certain guys. You're like, whoa, this guy just blew up in 3 months.
Sammy Sosa, two words.
Yeah, I mean, we knew. Owners probably knew. But at the same time, not everybody. There are some people that when they failed a drug test, I go, what? Are you kidding me? I never would have thought of that guy. So it's a tough call. But, you mentioned Barry Bonds, and Ed and I both comment that he is probably the best player in the game when he was playing, period.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a Hall of Famer before that, but he's the clown that went out there and said, you know what? I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
He chose to do something that he shouldn't have been doing, and he knew it. He's not a dumb person.
Right.
But it seems by all means accepted at that time that there wasn't any drug testing for that stuff.
Right.
Even though it's illegal, period. So you shouldn't be doing it. It's illegal.
Yeah.
Unless, a doctor prescribes it. So
right. All
these guys knew what they were doing. And for me, none of them, if there's any knowledge whatsoever or thought, they shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. No.
If he was a more likable human being, would writers look the other way a little bit, do you think, or not?
Cheater.
No.
Hard to say? No?
I'd say no.
No? Interesting.
He had the talent. There's no question about that.
Remember, easily.
They call them designer drugs for a reason.
Yeah.
They're designed to beat the test.
Yeah.
So if you took a pyramid of molecules to make up that drug,
and
you take one of those cells out, it used to be that they tested it wouldn't test positive because it had a molecule missing. So probably had some impact on his delivery to the baseball, either throwing it or hitting it. But they knew what they were doing. They cheated.
And some poor guy who ate a poppy seed bagel got tested positive.
Right. Yeah,
right.
I was having a Dunkin' Donut a few minutes ago, and I got to go out there against the guy. Please. Yeah.
It's the 27th annual fan convention. A lot of people will be there. Single and two-day passes sold out. How about that? There are some available. SoxFest@ShySox.com. Darren, it's so nice to meet you. Ed, it's wonderful to see you again.
Yeah, I'll be back tomorrow.
Oh, God.
Are you guys working tomorrow?
No.
Not usually, but we'll come in if you're in.
I'm on your side.
Get a restraining order, will you?
Just remember, when you come to our ballpark, Wendy.
Yes.
We will have some Dunkin' Donuts, but we're going to go to the Shy Sox Bar and Grill right across 35th Street.
Oh, nice.
And they're going to cook what you want for our broadcast, and you guys eat with us upstairs. Oh,
that would be excellent.
Got it?
I got to do some fundamentals, too.
Sure. Well, you want to catch rounders?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Bill, Wendy, thank you guys. It's been a pleasure.
Great to see you guys. Thanks so much.
Let's go, White Sox! Woo!
Absolutely.
It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. And on Sunday, January 27th, it's Holocaust Remembrance Day. And with us right now, Amanda Friedemann is in the studio. And you're an educator at the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. Amanda, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
I was talking to you off the air, and I said I'm kind of embarrassed to admit this, but when we learned about the Holocaust in school, they didn't go into very much detail. I really didn't learn that much. It was bad. I knew the general idea of the tragedy. But my kids are coming home with these facts that I'm like, wait a minute, that didn't happen. And they're not holding back. These kids are learning a lot more than we did.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The field of Holocaust education has evolved so much in particularly the last 20 years or so, but the way that this history was understood and taught about in schools in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s is completely different from what we're seeing today. Part of that is just the passage of time and the perspective of history. Part of that is the increasing willingness of survivors and eyewitnesses to tell their stories publicly and to share their experiences. And a big part of it is that we have, as a society, a deeper understanding of why this history is still so relevant and so important, and why learning about it and learning from it is essential to our collective understanding.
A couple of years ago on Holocaust Remembrance Day, I remember somebody saying time needed to pass so that we could all digest what happened. Do you agree with that? I'm not sure I do. Do you?
I do and I don't.
Yeah.
I think time definitely gives us perspective.
Yeah.
And any historian will tell you that contemporary history is a very different subject matter than history farther in the past, and the way that we're able to gain perspective on it and approach it in terms of understanding. But I think in the immediate years after the Holocaust, the world was recovering from so much, mm-hmm. from World War II and everything that that entailed, and the atrocities that we saw in the Holocaust, in the Pacific Theater. There was so much there that there was an instinct to kind of put it aside, move on, get back to normal. And that was very understandable in the time. But now, as time passes, people realize that that history needs to be dealt with,
sure.
both personally and collectively.
Right.
We also have a better understanding of psychology and PTSD and some of those issues that come into the larger story. But time gives us perspective. That's really the shortest answer to that.
What are your thoughts about Germany's take on the Holocaust at this point, where they really don't mess around? If you go to Germany, they are adamant that they made a mistake, that the Holocaust was the worst thing that could ever happen. They do not glorify Adolf Hitler in any way, mm-hmm. shape, and form. What are your thoughts on that? Yeah.
I think post-war Germany was completely admirable in the way that they accepted responsibility and acknowledged their actions and that they caused these atrocities to happen. They are pretty much the only country that had a perpetrator role in genocide that has fully accepted responsibility in that way. We don't necessarily see that in other situations. But what's alarming is that in recent years, we're starting to see a little bit of a shift in German culture.
Mm-hmm.
There is, we're starting to see a little bit less of an understanding of why this history is still relevant in Germany, why young people in Germany today do need to understand and learn and take responsibility for the actions of their great-grandparents.
Right.
Not that they personally did it,
right,
but that this is part of their collective history, that this is part of the larger story. And so there are efforts underway in Germany, in other countries in Europe, and here in the U.S. to keep this history relevant and to make sure that with the passage of time, we still understand that the history itself is important, but the lessons that we can learn from it,
sure,
are just as essential today as they were in the 1940s.
Yeah. She's Amanda Friedemann and Harvey L. Miller Family Youth Educator at the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center, which is in Skokie, 9603 Woods Drive. You can go to ilholocaustmuseum.org to find out information. Question for you, Amanda. Holocaust Remembrance Day was designed by the United Nations General Assembly November 1st, 2005. Why are we commemorating it now, January 27th?
The United Nations designated January 27th as the official International Day of Holocaust Remembrance because on January 27th, 1945, the Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp was liberated by the Soviet Army. And so in commemoration of that historic event and in memory of all of the Jewish and non-Jewish victims of the Holocaust, January 27th is the day that we mark.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting commemoration because when the United Nations declared Holocaust Remembrance Day, it was specifically designated not only as a day of commemoration and of memorialization, but as a day for education. So there's a dual purpose to the day. And so we remember and we honor the victims, but we also learn their stories, learn about their experiences, and keep their memories alive.
Do me a favor, spend a minute or two talking about the importance of bringing kids to the museum, because I've heard parents debate saying, I don't think my kids are ready for this.
Oh, they're ready.
But talk about that. What are your thoughts about a kid? What's an age range that is appropriate?
Absolutely. In our educational programs, we offer classroom-based content beginning at the kindergarten level all the way through college and university. We also offer field trip experiences for beginning at third grade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we're doing with kindergartners in their classrooms and third and fourth graders in our museum is very different from what we're doing with older students. But we have a sequenced series of field trips that we do with our younger visitors that begin with character education, with what in schools is known as social emotional learning. We teach them how to be a good neighbor, how to be a good friend, why it's important to get to know someone before you start making judgments about them, why it's important when you see a kid being picked on the playground, it's important to go get to intervene, to get them help, to stand up for them. And the reason that we start with these lessons is partly that it's helping our students to be good classroom citizens, to be positive members of their communities. But those lessons are an age-appropriate interpretation of what ultimately are the lessons of the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
What do we learn from the Holocaust? The dangers of stereotyping, the dangers of dividing people into us and them, the dangers when hatred and indifference cause people to fear differences among us and to act on that fear. And so if we can start with our younger students, our elementary students, and help them to learn that our differences are something to celebrate, that the things that we encounter with each other, the challenges we face are opportunities, not obstacles, then as they get into the older grades, when they start to learn the specific history, when they start to talk about the atrocities that happen, they have that foundation for understanding. They're approaching the history from a place of understanding our shared humanity. And that is better for them in their ultimate understanding, but it's better for all of us,
mm-hmm,
because this is creating the kinds of people that we want to share the world with.
Right.
This is at the heart of everything that we do.
The part that got me the most, what you just said, celebrate your differences.
Mm-hmm.
That should be done more. It just always isn't, but it should be.
I think everybody should be required to go to the museum now because we are not celebrating our differences. We're fighting our differences now.
Mm-hmm.
It's very frustrating. And you're having some special things going on Sunday, correct?
We are indeed.
Tell us about those.
On Sunday at 2 p.m. at the museum, we have a special program commemorating Holocaust Remembrance Day, and we are thrilled to be welcoming Patrice Ben-Simon, who has a lovely French accent, for those of you who are interested in such things.
Bill will be there.
He is the research director of an amazing organization based in France called Yahad Inunim. They are the leading organization on the ground in the former Soviet Union researching the Holocaust as it happened there. Something people are less familiar with about Holocaust history is that in the former Soviet Union, roughly 2 million people were murdered not by gas, but by bullets. There were mass shootings, and all over Eastern Europe, there are mass graves that still have not been located and identified. And Patrice and his organization are on the ground identifying, locating, and documenting these atrocities and gathering evidence of the crimes that happened there. They're actually still going into these villages and interviewing eyewitnesses.
Are they hesitant to talk to him?
Some of them. Some of them
are.
All
these years later, they're still hesitant.
And some of them are, there's a wide range of responses that he receives, but there are people that he has testimony interviews with people who are very matter-of-fact about what happened.
Right.
There are people who still live with the horror of what they witnessed. There's the full gamut of experiences. But what's important is that these crimes were committed 75 or more years ago. And so our opportunities to gather testimony, to gather the interview content from these eyewitnesses is slipping away.
Absolutely.
And so the work that he and his colleagues are doing is so, so important.
So any of the survivors now would have been children at the time, pretty much,
the majority. We have, on our speakers bureau, we have quite a few child survivors. We have teenagers. Our most senior member of our speakers bureau will be celebrating his 100th birthday in June.
God bless him.
Very excited about that. But in general, our survivors range from their late 70s to their mid-90s.
You're okay to stay for a little bit. We'll
Absolutely.
Take a quick break.
Sure.
Amanda Friedman is here. We'll talk more about the Illinois Holocaust Museum and the special day that's coming up on Sunday in just a little bit.
It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and we are talking to Amanda Friedman, who is Harvey L. Miller Family Youth Educator at the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. They will be celebrating Holocaust Remembrance Day. It's Remembrance Day?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
It is.
And that's this Sunday, January 27th. It's free to the public, correct?
It is.
All right. And you can go to ilholocaustmuseum.org for all the information.
There's a phrase, Amanda, that I think about all the time, and it's those who don't understand history are doomed to repeat it. Mm-hmm. I think the Holocaust plays into that to some extent. People always say, this can never happen again. Mm-hmm. Could something like this potentially ever happen again, do you think?
Depending on your definition of this,
yeah,
it's happened many times. Genocide has happened many times since the Holocaust. By some interpretations, genocide is happening in the world today
right now.
So the importance of learning these lessons has never gone away. How successful have we been so far at learning the lessons? I think we all have some work to do, but that's why we do everything that we do at the museum.
Yeah.
Is to make sure that our visitors have access to the information and, most importantly, to the stories of our survivors. The number most people know in terms of the Holocaust, the concept of 6 million Jews were killed.
Yeah.
That's overwhelming information. There's no way that we can really make sense of that. Exactly. And so one of the things that we do is try to really humanize the story. And so in our Karkomi Holocaust exhibition, which is the main core exhibition of our museum, we tell the larger story of the Holocaust through the artifacts, the experiences, and the personal narratives of survivors who ended up in the Chicago area and in the Midwest. And so we're introducing you to individual people telling you about what they experienced. And in many cases, these are people who still are with us and live in Skokie, and you might be going through the exhibition learning about their story, and they might walk by. And so having that personal connection not only makes it more relatable, but it takes this history that can sometimes seem like it happened a long time ago in faraway places, and it brings it right into our community.
Yep.
And that's, I think, a really important aspect of the remembrance and of really not just learning about, but understanding and learning from.
I think about these survivors, and there wasn't a lot of therapy that was going around as they were growing up. Some of them lost their parents, their families. It amazes me that they're so resilient.
Absolutely. Resilient is a great word for it. I sometimes refer to them as superheroes.
They are.
Their strength and their courage and their tenacity are the characteristics that helped them to survive and that they continue to display. There was really no formal kind of therapy or psychological support in the way that we understand it for the survivors, especially in the first few decades after the Holocaust. But what they did was they actually came together and talked to each other and supported each other.
It was like the first support group.
Mm-hmm. They really did kind of form their own support groups. And sometimes you'll hear people reference the fact that survivors didn't talk about what happened for many years. That's actually a little bit misleading because they talked to each other. It just took them a while to talk to everyone else,
right,
and to talk to the public. But they were always gathering together, remembering their families that they lost, remembering their lives before, and sharing their experiences with each other. And that formed incredibly strong bonds within survivor communities, and they became each other's families. Many children of survivors who are volunteers at our museum, and they talk about the fact that they didn't have grandparents or aunts and uncles, but their parents' survivor friends were their aunts and uncles.
Oh, yeah.
The other children of survivors were their cousins. And so we see these new families start to form from those who managed to survive.
Yeah. Is it sometimes hard for you to look at artifacts, uniforms, clothing from that era? I literally get hot and cold at the same time
even
when I'm in the presence.
Even just talking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those reactions are actually really positive that you're having. This is emotional history. These are things that happen to real people. And if we didn't have an emotional reaction to it, that would not necessarily be a good sign.
Right.
The fact that you're reacting means that you're connecting to that humanity that I mentioned earlier. I've been doing this for a lot of years, but I still react. I still get choked up when I hear a survivor talk about their experience. I think if I didn't get emotional, I wouldn't be able to do the work.
Right.
And so we're talking about one of the darkest events in human history. If we didn't get emotional about it, I'm not sure what that would mean.
Yeah, agreed. Something would be wrong. You'd be broken. Yeah.
Thank you for all the work you do. Sunday, Holocaust Remembrance Day, January 27th. What time do the programs begin on Sunday?
Begins at 2 o'clock.
And more information can be found at ilholocaustmuseum.org. Thank you so much for sharing this with us today. We really appreciate it.
You are very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Great to see you, Amanda. A break, some news, more show.
And coming up, the stories that matter with Steve Bertrand from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.
Thanks, Steve. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. Our guest is Alexander Zalbin. He is the managing editor over at Decider.com, a wonderful website if you're a TV fan, if you like your entertainment. Hi, Alex. I hope it's warmer where you are than it is here in Chicago. Is it?
Ever so slightly. We had a rough beginning of the week, but it kind of has warmed up relatively to about 30-ish degrees So, you know, I'm going swimming later today.
Where are you? New York?
New York, yeah.
Yeah.
A balmy 30.
I'd take it.
Yeah, take that in a minute. Yes. Alex, I've noticed there's a lot of television shows on right now, and I don't know if this is a new thing or I just hadn't noticed it. There's a lot of shows where people have to climb obstacle courses and be big and muscular. Have you noticed that too?
There's definitely a lot of contest shows and a lot of game shows going on right now. I think My theory on that, things like the Titan Games, The Rock that's just premiered, and of course there's been American Ninja Warrior. I do think part of it is the success of the American Ninja Warrior series that's kind of trucked on really nicely. Wrestling has also very much come back and been big in the culture.
Yeah.
So I think people are looking for kind of their own takes on that, but also I think people are just looking for escape. They're not looking for something with a plot. They're not looking for something that can be, you know, negative or snarky or vicious like reality shows sometimes can be. A fun competition show where people just show out how strong they are, that's fun.
I wonder what kind of rider they must sign, because in almost every one of them, they're knocked off a pole that's three stories high by a giant cushion that knocks them into some liquid. They must sign their lives away just saying, yeah, whatever happens, I'm going to take full responsibility, don't you think?
Absolutely. I don't have any inside legal knowledge about any of those contracts, but when you're going into that sort of things, those networks, those production companies are going to protect themselves within an inch of their life. So, yeah, you're basically, your life is forfeit if you decide to be on the Titan Gate.
Even Ellen DeGeneres, who's the nicest person in the world, on her show, it always ends with every contestant taking a giant fall.
That's
crazy.
That's kind of stupid, I got to tell you.
I know.
And can I just talk about something without a plot, Alexander? I'm a big Big Brother fan. I tried to watch the Celebrity Big Brother with Anthony Scaramucci with what's her name's mom?
Lindsay Lohan's mom. Tom Green and his mom.
Ryan Lochte. It's unwatchable. Yeah. I cannot, because it's different when you have people who are not celebrities. These guys are just mugging for I can't watch it. I hate it. I'm done. That's all I'm saying.
I'm sorry to hear that. I'm sorry it's not working out. It didn't work out for Anthony Scaramucci either. He left in 6 days.
Oh, is he gone?
I haven't even known that, but I knew he'd be the first to go.
So can he still
Scaramucci? I think.
Will he still qualify to be on The Masked Singer, or is he done for the season?
He's on it at the same time. That's the crazy thing. He's the bee.
I don't know how he does it. All right, this is sad. The final six episodes of what I think is one of the funniest shows on TV, The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Why are they putting an end to the show?
They kind of just decided it's time. That's basically the thing. It's not being canceled or anything like that. Netflix still really like the show, but they've told the story they want to tell. Ellie Kemper is a star who wants to go on to do other things. I think the rest of the cast wants to do other things as well. They may come back and do a movie. It's something they've talked about offhand. I don't know if it would be a Netflix movie or a theatrical movie, but it's something they've been discussing for about a year in different aspects. So we'll see if that happens. But the last six episodes are on today, and they're as ridiculous and goofy, as fun as you'd expect. There's a Sliding Doors-inspired episode that shows you what would have happened if, I'm not even joking about this, if Kimmy and Titus had gone to see Sliding Doors in theaters and how the world would have changed. It's ridiculous and great, and it ends on a very sweet, poignant note that I won't spoil here.
Oh, she's makes very sweet.
She's so funny.
And funny.
Yeah. Somebody who works on the show explained that one of the cast members, for those of you who don't watch the show, is the great Carol Kane, who's been in movies and television shows. She was Latka's mother on Taxi. They said that in every episode, at least once or twice, she'll do a scene and then have them explain what it meant to her. She doesn't understand the meaning of the scene. She just knows that's what it says in the script, so I guess I have to say these words, but I don't get them.
Oh, that's amazing. She's so fantastic on the show. She's such a wonderful actress. I can't wait to see what she does next as well, because I will watch literally anything with her in it.
Excellent. Netflix has a show, Black Earth Rising. What is this and when does it start?
Sure. So eight episodes. It's actually a British thriller. It premiered in the UK to very good reviews. Here in America, it's been a little bit mixed, but as far as I hear, it's a slow burn if you want to stick with it. Stars Michaela Cole, who's fantastic, as a survivor of the Rwandan genocide. So as you can probably tell, it's a very, very serious show. She gets involved in a trial being held by the International Criminal Court. John Goodman is also in it. Also, Sabrina Spee, very good. Again, this is not your chill out and turn on Netflix show. But if you are looking for something super serious with some really strong performances, that might be one worth checking out this weekend.
Do you see a trend there a little bit in shows that were kind of hits or underground hits in Great Britain and then all of a sudden getting more access here in the United States?
That's definitely something that Netflix is going for. I don't know if you guys watched The Bodyguard that was on, I believe, towards the end of last year on Netflix. That was another transplant from Britain, which was, I believe, their hugest hit since Downton Abbey over there. And then it came over here, and it was also a huge hit on Netflix. So I think that sort of thing certainly emboldens the service to pick up more shows like that, like The Bodyguard, like Black Earth Rising. So
Black Mirror, too, right, Alex? Did Black Mirror start out that way?
Yeah, Black Mirror started out that way, but it actually is a co-production between Netflix and ITV. Something like Black Earth Rising or Bodyguard is a straight transplant. They just take the series and put it on Netflix as a quote-unquote Netflix original.
Interesting, interesting. We'll take a little bit of a break. Alex Zelbin is here, managing editor of Decider.com. We're talking TV. Do you have any questions or comments? We can be reached at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and it's Wendy on WGN. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. Our guest is Alexander Zelbin. He's the managing editor of Decider.com, a wonderful website if you're a fan of show business and entertainment type stories. Alex, we were just talking about shows that started out in England and then came to the United States. This show about R. Kelly got a lot of people watching and talking about it. And I thought to myself as I was watching it, I'm shocked that nobody's done anything like this with Michael Jackson's story. It turns out in England, they made a documentary about it, and I guess it's going to be on HBO fairly soon. Do you know anything about this?
Yeah, this is called Leaving Neverland, and it's, I believe, premiering at Sundance, and there's already been a bunch of protests and controversy around it. It should be, I'm actually looking up the information so I don't get it wrong right now, but I believe it's premiering pretty soon, and as you mentioned, like the R. Kelly doc, it's pretty damning in terms of Michael Jackson. For those who don't remember, prior to his death, there were a lot of allegations against him, and frankly, I think a lot of those fell away when he rather suddenly died. But it is going to be on HBO and Channel 4. I guess there isn't a date as of yet. It should be sometime this spring. Probably once Sundance has passed, that's going on over in Park City right now, we should have a clearer sense of the date of when it's going to premiere.
Will this be a new thing for 2019, 2020, and beyond, where we take people who were once icons, heroes, and then we kind of dissect them and find that there was a darker side to them? Do you think more of that will come down the pike?
You know, you could probably argue that this is an outgrowth of the Me Too movement. There were people that were open secrets who got exposed out there. You know, we've talked quite a bit on this program about Les Moonves, but there was also Harvey Weinstein, of course, and many other people like that. And now we're getting a second wave. We have that big article about director Bryan Singer, who directed Bohemian Rhapsody, come out of the Atlantic, I believe, actually, earlier this week. This has been a very long week. So those are another open allegations that are now publicly out there that people can do with as they wish. And I think we've seen the same thing with R. Kelly. We've seen the same thing with Michael Jackson. I think people are going back now and working harder to get that second wave of actual proof, actual people on record, fact-check things rather than rumor and supposition. So I think that's what we're going to be seeing throughout the year.
The Bohemian Rhapsody guy, what's his name, Singer?
Bryan Singer.
Bryan Singer. I didn't know that at all. I felt foolish that I didn't know that story. And then when it was released this week when I saw it, I also didn't know that he was fired from Bohemian Rhapsody before it wrapped. Rami Malek said he didn't know of any of these allegations. And he's been hired to do another movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they announced that the other day. It's an adaptation of the comic book series Red Sonja by Millennium Films. And I will mention, without getting too much in depth, several people have pointed out online that Millennium Films has had its own problems with sexual harassment. They came out and said, we're still keeping Bryan Singer on. Bohemian Rhapsody was a huge hit. We're not changing course at all. And there was huge uproar about that yesterday. So we'll have to see how that turns out in the long run.
There was just a story about the director of Green Book, Farrelly, that he had not been the best.
Really?
Angel. Yeah.
Good God.
Yeah. And he kind of admits to that too. He's not backing away from that one.
Yeah, I mean, listen, not that any of this behavior is necessarily excusable, but the way to go is not digging down and fighting against it. The way of going is being honest, being open, and actually trying to change and taking palpable steps to change. I haven't read about the Peter Farrelly thing, but hopefully he's doing something like that, and I guess we'll have to see what happens with him as well.
And I would also throw in, with everything you said, don't just apologize, but be honest in your apology. That seems to be the thing that's lacking
sincere
for most of these. Yeah, be very sincere. I don't know why they don't get that.
Well, and even beyond sincerity, it's more than a apology. You actually, not to, you know, get on my high horse or anything, but you actually need to take palpable steps. You need to go into therapy. You need to be talking to somebody. There was another uproar about John Lasseter, the former head of Pixar, who was accused of multiple counts of sexual harassment, left the company, left Disney, and is now moving over to Skydance Animation and took charge, and everybody was very upset about that. His one thing that he said is, you know, I've had a year to really think about it. That's not enough. Just, you know, sitting in your chair and puttering around your house and kind of thinking about the things you've done. You really do need to go for some sort of professional help, even if you don't believe you did anything, to understand why people think you did this stuff.
Yep.
So that you can have some sort of, you know, show your work.
No question about it.
We got a text. I love the kids are all right. What does Alex think about that? I just tuned in. I have to say I was biased because my friend Lisa Nelson has written some episodes. She writes for the show. Tim Doyle created it, so that's why I started watching it. I am 100% loving that show.
Yeah, I know we've talked about it before, and I enjoyed the pilot, and I enjoy the cast. It's one of those that, unfortunately, I haven't really kept up with. But I will say, if you are enjoying the show, I know it's been posting pretty solid ratings across the board. So I believe that's good for the future. I think we probably will be seeing more episodes of that and potentially a season two pickup.
It has a Wonder Years-y feel to it, doesn't it, kind of?
Different. It's almost like I'm thinking Goldberg's little bit and the Wonder Years, but it's truly different.
Yeah.
Someone else has texted the other two, new on Comedy Central, so funny. Your thoughts for its longevity?
The other two, right up until the end, I was on board. The other two is fantastic. If you haven't checked it out, it's from two former head writers of Saturday Night Live. The idea is that these two, an expiring actor and basically a girl who doesn't know what she's doing with her life, their younger brother becomes a viral sensation, and it seems that he's going to be like the next Justin Bieber, and they decide to tag along. They decide to essentially ride his fame as far as they possibly can. It's sweet. It's funny. Molly Shannon is in it. Ken Marino, who you probably recognize the face of, is the manager, and he's playing dumb and funny as well. In terms of longevity, I don't know. That's always a little bit up in the air when it comes to Comedy Central, because a lot of their shows, to be honest, don't get a lot of viewers, but I hope it lasts for a while because I really enjoyed the pilot a lot.
Sarah Schneider and Chris Kelly are the former SNL alums. I never even heard of this till the listener texted us.
You can actually, I believe, check out the pilot on YouTube. So it's about, you know, 25 minutes long, easy watch, a lot of fun, pretty cute and funny. So I definitely recommend it.
Alex, the last couple of years, we've been treated to various Broadway musicals done on television live. There's another one coming on Sunday. What is it?
It is Rent Live. It's coming Sunday, as you mentioned, to Fox at 8 p.m. It is starring an eclectic cast of performers. I think that's the way to put it. You got Vanessa Hudgens, you might recognize from High School Musical, as Maureen Johnson, if you know that name. If you're a fan of RuPaul's Drag Race, Valentina is going to be starring as Angel. Also, the musical artist Tina Shea is in it. And there's a couple of YouTube and viral type stars as well. Brennan Hunt is one of the folks in there that I think younger people might know the name of. Should be very interesting because it's very much, for those who don't know Rent, it's very much a musical, I think, of its time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot built around it. Obviously, the music is classic. It'll be very curious and interesting to see how they do it on TV, but I know a lot of people are very excited.
Watching these live productions is awe-inspiring. I've seen a couple of them, and so much goes into it. The choreography of getting the sets and everything going for live TV is amazing. They can pull it off. So that's Sunday night on Fox, right?
Yeah, that's Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Fox. And I agree, particularly when they show during commercials, kind of behind the scenes, moving the sets around or anything like that. Love that. Yeah. The best.
I like AP Bio. I saw a promo that's going to be starting up in a couple of weeks with Glenn Howerton from Always Sunny. And please tell me what's going on with Caitlin Olson. I miss the Mick, and I want to see her on something soon.
Well, she was just on the last season of It's Always Sunny, which was great as usual. So if you missed that, definitely check that out. I don't know necessarily what she's doing next, to be honest with you. I think she's doing a guest voice on Bob's Burgers, but that's it.
It's not going to work for me.
Wendy, we need some more.
I agree with you. She's fantastic, and I want to see her in absolutely everything.
I'm just going to invite her over to my house, Alex. I'll have you over as well. I love her so much.
All right, Alex, here's the strangest text of the week. Ask Alex if he is now or has ever been married to a clown. Do you know what that means?
I do know what that means. So my wife actually has a couple of relatives in the Chicago area, so that's probably from one of them.
Are you currently married to a clown?
She is an ex-clown.
An ex-clown.
Ex-clown. She was a Ringling Brothers circus clown for 4 years, lived on the road before I met her.
That's amazing. Was it a circus-themed wedding for the two of you or not?
No, we did have a couple of Muppet Show type things, but no circus stuff. Oh. But I have been to the circus a lot more post-marriage than pre-marriage.
Wow, it shows there's life after circus. Normal life
yeah,
after
there's
circus.
Normal life after circus. Alex, I want to just quickly mention a binge-worthy show, and everyone's already on board with this show, but for some reason I just started watching it a few weeks ago. Jerry Seinfeld show, where he and another comedian go and just get coffee and talk about the world. It's the easiest show in the world to binge watch because every episode's about 20 minutes long, and you already know how funny Jerry Seinfeld is, but he's got comics from the old days right up until the more current stars. Every episode I see makes me laugh out loud several times. What a great show.
Yeah, you can check it out on Netflix. There's tons and tons of episodes, as you mentioned. I highly recommend the John Mulaney episode.
Oh, I saw it the other night. It was hysterical.
So good.
Where they go carpet shopping?
Definitely check that out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, John Mulaney is great. I believe that's the 9th episode of the 10th season, if you want to head right to it. There's no plot. You can jump in on any episode.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to watch. Alex, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you have a great week, and we'll talk to you again next Friday.
All right. Thanks so much, guys.
It's Alex Zeldin. He's the managing editor of Decider.com.
And
married to a former clown.
That's good to know. I love your inside scoop. Again, you prove that you are the male Rona Barrett.
Oh, thank you,
with
Wendy.
The same haircut.
That's very nice of you. Thank you.
Which is not a slam to you.
No, not at all. Thanks, David. It's Bill Luff. It's Wendy Snyder. Steve Bertrand is in studio with us because we just got a press conference from Roger Stone, who says he will plead not guilty. Steve, you have a little bit of insight.
Well, I didn't. I was in the other room, so I didn't hear what Stone had to say. But there's a documentary out called Get Me Roger Stone.
I don't even know really who he is exactly.
He's been around for decades.
I know that.
He goes back to Watergate. He's got Richard Nixon tattooed on his back. He is a larger...
He's not. I know that sounds like the kind of thing you'd make up. He's not making
his
that
name or of his face?
I think it's his face.
That is weird.
There's a lot. This guy is a larger than life character. I mean, truly, the name of the documentary, Get Me Roger Stone, comes from James Baker, who in the year 2000, standoff in Florida.
Yes.
Baker was running the recount for George Bush, and he said, "Get me Roger Stone," supposedly at a meeting. Stone goes down there, and then he starts rabble-rousing, getting people to protest and, storm the Chad counters. Remember when that was happening?
Yep.
Well, the dangling Chad.
If you ask Roger Stone, he was the guy behind all of that. Now, a lot of these things are, you ask Roger Stone, and it's his version. I mean, he's got his own version of his life that is fantastical in many ways.
Well, you mentioned the Richard Nixon tattoo. He had some involvement in the Watergate cover-up, didn't he?
Yeah, I don't know if he testified before the committee, but he was involved in the Nixon administration.
Yeah.
He was involved with Paul Manafort and I think Charlie Black for a time. So he's always been sort of a dirty trickster and proud of it and brags about it. And so he was cracking people up at his news conference just there. I'm sure David will have more coming up at noon about what he had to say. But the guy is just, then there were the whole sex clubs he was involved in. He was just on the verge, according to the documentary, of really making it big as a political consultant. And then he got busted for, there was some sex thing going on.
Does having a Richard Nixon tattoo at a sex club help your profile or hurt your profile?
It is right behind his,
depends on the time of night, Bill.
It's in between his upper shoulders, right under his neck, and I would say it's about 4 to 5 inches tall, Tricky Dick's head.
Yes.
And he's, Stone is a weightlifter, a bodybuilder.
He's in good shape.
Yeah. It's really, I keep telling people in the Mincing Rascals, recommending this documentary. It's fascinating.
It's on Netflix.
How old of a documentary?
2017.
Paul Manafort is featured in it prominently talking about how close Donald Trump and Roger Stone
really
are. So it was pre-investigation, but post It was during the campaign, I think, that it came out.
All right. I know this is just speculation, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Going forward with this, with what's happening today with Roger Stone, what does that mean in the big picture of Donald Trump?
Well, the Trump campaign was mentioned many, many times in the indictment. So clearly there's a connection to the campaign. He talked about campaign officials he reported to.
Yeah.
So it's not good.
It says longtime Trump advisor Roger Stone, who helped create the real estate mogul's political career. Yeah. So it just seems.
But he's also a liar.
Yeah.
I mean,
Stone.
So much of what he says is comical, but you don't know if it's true because it's just so outrageous.
But if he's brought into a courtroom, that has to or should stop. Right?
What stops anymore?
They swear you in.
Doesn't matter anymore, does it?
The whole truth and nothing but the truth.
Who's the character? Oliver North, mm-hmm. right? Now, I don't compare him to Stone, but, you know, Oliver North has become an American character mm-hmm. in history. This guy, if he gets his window of fame, is going to be someone that people are going to talk about for decades.
Yeah.
Because I'm just telling you, if you just watch the documentary, you'll love it. Get Me Roger Stone.
I'm going to find it.
Earlier, Bob Mueller said that today, in fact. He said, get me Roger Stone.
He did. Your idea
that's
about
the Bertrand
this.
Humor I love.
Roger Moore, the polarizing filmmaker, was on with Stephen Colbert, and he said that this government shutdown is something of a smokescreen to take America's mind off of what's really going on. The idea that Donald Trump could have collusion and everything that is a byproduct of that. Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
Michael Moore, not Roger Moore.
Sorry about that.
That seems a little far-fetched to me.
Yeah. Because it's just a coincidence that the timing is the way it is.
Well, I mean, maybe it's part of the whole thing, Donald Trump wanting to really keep his hardcore base, and this is a way to do it.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't think that there's any illusion that this is going to detract from what's really going to happen with the Mueller investigation.
Yeah.
Doesn't his hardcore base fly and perhaps will come into difficulties flying? Doesn't this get to a
numbers,
point with
his
somebody?
His numbers have been going down. His numbers among non-college educated white men, which was a real strong area for him, have been dropping. So, yeah, he's been suffering through this.
Is LaGuardia the first of what could be several airports to close because of this, or do we not know?
I think what happened was, and I wasn't expecting to talk to you about this, so this is my theory, but they stopped taking landings today because the FAA then put out a statement that they needed to do some things with spacing and all of that. So I think they probably shut it down for a time. A ground halt, right, so that they could reconfigure the spacing and put the personnel in the right spot and then resume.
For people who don't know, LaGuardia
So it wasn't the sort of thing where there were so few workers that they had to shut the airport down.
Right.
Yeah.
If you don't know this, LaGuardia was already under heavy construction. So this just plays into the confusion at LaGuardia, not in a positive way, obviously, if they're closing it down.
Right.
But I wonder going forward, because it's been intimated from several sources that as the shutdown continues, it'll be harder and harder to keep the airports running.
Well, I mean, I think you might see some organized efforts to have an impact.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you're among thousands of air traffic controllers not being paid and nothing's being done about it,
why continue to work?
They've got muscle.
Right.
If they don't show up, something happens.
Right. But that could be the linchpin in all of this.
Well, maybe, yeah.
Right?
Although I think it really looks like maybe that happened yesterday when the Democratic plan in the Senate got more votes than the Republican plan.
Yeah.
And then Schumer and McConnell sat down, and even the president kind of spoke favorably about maybe a compromise coming. So we could be getting close to the end.
Are we all allowed to use Donald Trump's nickname for Nancy Pelosi?
What is it?
Do you not know this?
No.
Jazz, do you have the audio on this?
Nancy?
Donald Trump, who's a master at giving people nicknames. You pick your favorite. There's been several over the years.
Low energy.
It was also Lion Ted.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm sorry.
Little Marco from Marco Rubio is a great one. Pocahontas, the most upsetting of all of them so far. But then he came up with one for Nancy Pelosi that is just brilliant. Do you have it, Jazz? You don't have it? All right. We'll find it.
Because I heard him, I thought it was just yesterday or the day before, saying, Nancy, I call her Nancy.
That's the one.
That's it, okay, Nancy, as I call her. Okay. Hang on, here it is.
Here's the audio.
Nancy Pelosi, or Nancy, as I call her.
He's a genius.
But there's something to be said for that, because she's the only one who he hasn't come up with the derogatory nickname for.
So in saying that...
No, it's
you're
true.
Right.
You know, in saying what he just said, Nancy, or as I call her Nancy, was he commenting on the fact?
I think so. People
was
been,
he?
I think people have been saying on TV, you know, is he afraid of her or is he intimidated? He doesn't have a nickname for her. And so then the next day he kind of came out and said, as I call her, Nancy.
That's amazing.
Never a dull moment, guys.
Never a dull moment. All right, a break. Thanks, Steve, for hanging out.
Bill Leff. I call him Bill.
Did you come up with that?
Yes,
that's great.
Isn't that good?
That's very good. And Wendy Snyder, whose nickname I can't say on the air. We're here with
you're
you.
Such
we'll
a
be
jerk on a Friday.
Here until noon, and then we go to the stream, Wendy, for the bonus hour. 1 hour of just unbridled radio where anything can happen.
Usually does.
Jerry Nunn will be with us to
he
tell
just
us.
Got hit by a car yesterday. He got rear-ended.
He did.
And he might have whiplash.
Oh, no.
Not my tempo.
I hope that's not true. The other day, you and I were talking about Tom Brady, who will be making his annual trip to the Super Bowl. Every year, as we come to late January and early February, Tom Brady and his family are at the Super Bowl.
Blah, blah, blah. Who cares?
You said you don't like Tom Brady for a couple reasons. One reason you said is he's just too good.
No, I just said he's just smug. It's not that he's too good. I'm sick of seeing him at the Super Bowl, and he's a cheater.
The other reason you mentioned is that.
He's a cheater.
Is that he's a cheater. Now, you're referring to the inflatable balls controversy.
The deflated balls,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, from a couple years ago. Still upset about that, obviously. Did you lose money in a bet on
no,
that?
No, I don't place bets on teams. Occasionally I'll buy a square here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Could you spare a square?
I don't think that's the same thing. I think that's different.
But I didn't lose money, and, you know, I guess he came back and proved it the following year, kind of cheater's proof kind of thing. But it just changed my opinion of him.
He won the Super Bowl a couple years ago. He lost last year. And again, he's in it. He'll be in it in a week, a little over a week. There's a little boy named Ace Davis. That's a real kid's name. That sounds like the kind of name, if you had a cartoon family, you would name your child Ace Davis, doesn't it? Ace Davis wanted to prove that Tom Brady was a cheater through science. He's a 10-year-old kid. I give
Look
him credit.
At that.
And he used examples. This is for a science fair project, by the way. He used examples such as how deflated footballs would give Tom Brady a competitive advantage. For his project, he even included results of an experiment that he did with his mom and his sister using footballs of various inflation. Now, if you remember at the time of this scandal, and it did, it rocked the NFL, if not the world, people said, he's so good, why bother deflating a football?
Question.
He doesn't need that. But he felt that it gave him an advantage.
Well, better grip.
Better grip. But it would also give the other quarterback better grip. They don't use a separate set of footballs.
No, yes they do. I thought that was the whole thing.
No, the football's just on the field. Let's say it's the Patriots playing whatever team. Just pick a team, the Titans. So
yeah, but if you're not used to getting a deflated ball, maybe
that would play into it a little bit.
That would mess with you a little bit if you weren't prepared for it. But wouldn't the other people who touched the ball say,
they would notice.
This ball seems a little flat.
Yeah, give me a different one.
Would you get
one.
It out of my closet?
Right.
You know how you always have a flat basketball or football in the back of your closet
yes,
somewhere?
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
How come no one really mentioned it?
I don't know. He found he being Ace Davis, private detective.
Teen detective.
Doesn't sound, if you were in a bookstore and you saw a series of books.
Yes.
Ace Davis, teen detective? I got to get these for somebody. He, Ace Davis, found that the least inflated football went the farthest, which you'd imagine, right?
Wouldn't I you wouldn't,
think?
No.
You wouldn't think so?
Because, you know, I just think if it was firm and heavier, it would go farther instead of wobbling if it was deflated.
But if it was firm and heavier, it would be harder to make the ball travel because it's heavier. It wouldn't travel quite as far. And we're only talking, I think they said at the time of the scandal.
It was a slight
It
difference.
Was a very, very, like they were looking at 1 or 2 percentage different points.
Still
and that's,
cheating.
That's not enough. It's still
it's
cheating.
Enough to cheat.
It's still cheating. He also included several pictures of Tom Brady crying or making weird faces.
Well, what is that? What did that have to contribute to the sign?
On.
Yeah, that
he's
little
just,
bit.
I'm proud of that kid. That's how Ace Davis works, Wendy. You know that.
Ace Davis, teen piler honor.
Yep. That's what it says under his yearbook picture. He also added a picture of himself in his football uniform with a green check mark while he put a red X over Tom Brady's picture. Oh, that's just spiteful. I don't think I play by those rules. He did this because he says, I hate Tom Brady. He's been accused of cheating before, and I want him caught. In case you're wondering, that seems like big words for a 10-year-old kid. In case you're wondering which quarterback Ace Davis likes, his favorite is Winston, the quarterback for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who's not a cheater. He's never been accused of cheating. Unfortunately for Ace, he and the rest of us have to watch Tom Brady compete in another Super Bowl, as the Patriots will face off against the Los Angeles Rams, not this Sunday, Wendy, because you need 2 weeks in the middle. You can't just have the season and then the Super Bowl. You got to let 14 days come and go, because we can't handle – that's too much excitement for us. We must give it some time. By the way, Adam Hoge, our own Adam Hoge, will be at the Super Bowl all of next week, and he'll do a show. You know, our show goes from noon to 1 on the stream. Adam Hoge will also have a show for an hour every day next week, where he will talk to the people who are around the Super Bowl, people involved with the Super Bowl.
Fans?
There might be some fans. Here's what always happens at the Super Bowl. They always send guys like former NFL greats always show up.
Yeah.
Or like the top sports writers or sports broadcasters, they always show up. So he'll have a bunch of those people on. I know people are going, what about Ace Davis? Will he be? I don't know that he will be there.
We should get him over there somehow.
Ace Davis?
Yeah.
I would like to. He has a prediction, Ace Davis does. Julian Edelman pushes everyone around, he says. Gronkowski gets shut down.
Gronk!
That was great, Wendy. That was wonderful. Gurley runs for 2 touchdowns. Well, that's not nice.
I don't know who that is.
Brady plays terrible.
That's incorrect
Ace
English.
Davis, hater of all things Tom Brady.
Terribly.
There will be 3 interceptions, and he says the Rams will win by a score of 30-14. I don't see that happening.
If Tom Brady had, I don't know what the description would be, but if he had his druthers.
I think that's the scientific term, yeah.
He would call this kid and ask to talk to him and have an interview with him.
Do you think so?
If I was Tom Brady,
what would that phone call? Wouldn't that be a spiteful phone call?
No, because I bet this kid all of a sudden switches his tune if it's like, "Hey Ace, although you don't have a home phone anymore, so
right.
Tom Brady would just call him. He'd pick it up. Yeah, this is Ace. Who's this? Ace Davis speaking. Who's this? Tom Brady. I think the kid would like.
He'd freeze.
Yes, and
right.
then he'd go.
Hey, Mr. Brady.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
So if I was Tom Brady.
By the way, I didn't have to change my voice at all for doing that impression of 10-year-old Ace Davis. It cracked at just the right time.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm very seldomly correct. Matt, are you here to defend me for the first time ever?
Yes, I am, Wendy.
All right, what's going on? We were talking about deflated footballs, and I said, why didn't the other team feel it? And I said, oh, yeah, they switched balls, but Bill says no. What's going on?
Each team brings their own set of footballs that are inflated, and they sit in a guarded room. They're checked one time before they go onto the field.
And during play, the balls change as each team goes from defense to offense?
Correct.
Wait.
How did you not know that?
I've never heard of that before. If that were true, then why wouldn't every team inflate or deflate to their heart's content?
Because there's an official that checks the poundage in each one to make sure it's within the range that it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
New England tampered with their footballs after they were done.
Mm.
So the referee must have at some point touched that football, though, right?
No, they deflated it after the official checked it, is what Matt said. I'm with Ace Davis.
But you would have had to have done that right there on the field. You can't take the ball away under the stands, deflate it, and bring it back on. There's no time.
Matt, your answer?
Then I don't know how they would have done it, but that's... That's why they had an advantage, because the other team was playing with a fully inflated football where Tom Brady was not.
So it's not like a baseball game where it's one ball unless something happens to it and the ump throws a new right. one in. Each team has their own offensive football, I guess.
Correct.
Something I learned today. You're going to check that.
Tom Brady
feeling.
Is a cheater or not a cheater? What do you think? Matt?
I think he's a cheater.
He's
and
a cheater.
So is his coach.
Bill Belichick is a cheater.
At least he smiles all the yes. time.
Ace Davis is a cheater.
No, he's,
no,
not,
he's not
a cheater.
No, he's just a kid.
Ace Davis is a truth teller.
Yeah, that's what he is. That's what he is.
Have
Matt,
a great
thank
weekend,
you.
Matt. Stay warm.
Yep.
Now, you dispute this. You're going to do some research before we go to the
I need
stream.
To see, because I can't imagine a scenario where a referee would touch a football in an NFL game, and then somehow the football would find its way somewhere where it could be deflated and brought back on the field. That's impossible. How could that be?
I don't know.
Somebody would notice that the football was missing.
No, there are probably a ton of them, and then they grab a random one and check the pounds per square inch. Who wants to jump in? Bertrand? Steve Bertrand?
No, who, Jasmine? Yeah? All right, Steve, go ahead.
He wants to jump in, but he's not jumping in. Where is he?
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. We're doing studio mixes. Sorry about that.
All right, so want to jump in on the footballs.
Yeah, there's a ballroom. So each team brings its balls.
I would like to work there.
Each team, this is my recollection, each team brings their balls to the ballroom.
Yes.
They're checked by the officials then, and then they're used during the game during play, so they're not checked again by the official.
Oh, they're only
and
checked prior.
And I think the allegation was maybe someone sneaked into the ballroom and let them out and weren't checked then.
All right. That makes more sense. That scenario makes more sense to me. So should Tom Brady still be allowed to play on Sunday or not, next Sunday or not?
He was already punished for cheating.
He's already in.
We have to break, and then we'll talk to Bertrand again. How does that sound? Coming up, the stories that matter with David Jennings from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.